Welcome to Life's a Breach, a Cybercrime Magazine podcast series brought to you by Security Scorecard, the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with millions of organizations continuously rated. Through a customer-centric, solution-based commitment to their partners, Security Scorecard is transforming the digital landscape by building a path toward resilience. To learn more about our sponsor, visit securityscorecard.com. I'm your host, Hillary McClure, Vice President of Multimedia Productions at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today is Dr. Andre Crejo, Chief Scientist and Fellow, Cyber Risk and Resilience Services at Security Scorecard. Welcome back, Andre. It's so great to have you with us today.
Have a great day, Hillary, and I'm very happy and pleased to be back at the podcast.
Yes, we're happy to have you back. And so, Andre, we know that it's not a matter of if an organization will get attacked, but when. So for today's episode, and to build on what we covered together last time, I'd like for us to go a little deeper and clear up some misconceptions about cyber retainers and why they're an essential part of any risk management strategy, especially being key to cyber resilience. So with all of that, can you tell us about some of the most, I guess, memorable incident response scenarios that you've encountered?
One happened here on a company that's very significant player in a credit card industry, but not necessarily collecting a payment, but collecting intelligence on what buyers are actually buying and how to influence, let's say, store organization of items or a population, certain population by demographics and income to buy certain goods. And that statistical data analytics, it can be very prevalent in the retail business. Knowing your customer, his habits when they walk into the store, what they need to find on the first shelf, what generations are inclined to buy, let's say a toothpaste, right? So maybe someone who is older buys certain brand, someone who is younger buys different brand, different preferences. And this organization we knew for a while, and it was always a little bit of belief and denial that an attack can happen. And organization was attacked by a very well-known, notorious Russian ransomware group. And we were in a fight for 2 weeks for their life, not to get encrypted. And 24/7, and going through the command, create a command center, create a rotation of resources. It's a organization has 24/7 worldwide coverage, meaning they have a heavy office in Ireland, their office in Asia. This business is very global. It was a very different experience. Like whenever we practice or work with them, now they had to go through real fight for the company for 2 weeks. And every day in the morning when we woke up, we were thinking, did anything get encrypted? And we were rotating our shifts, they were rotating their shifts. And it was a very intense experience. A lot of different feelings, emotions came into it from executive management, from their board. The company was in the middle of their very large M&A to be purchased too. So this came at the time when resources really needed to do something else at a point of a time. And this attack, you know, came really wrong time. So the threat actors profile you at the weakest point. That's the message here. The cyber insurance was very heavy, meaning the company had a lot of coverage to pay, which also attracts the hackers, the understanding of that the carrier, insurance carrier, so they knew there's money on the table, and we're talking somewhere between $25 to $50 million of ransom. And we worked with that victim through that 2 weeks. We put a real fight with the threat actors. We were able to close with containment eradication, full termination of the adversaries. But not every story of such a bad cyber cancer ends that way, especially in the very high ransom. But through understanding how difficult and hard for the team was, also for us and for them, came at the end when the CEO and the board asked for a presentation. And we did that. And I was asked some of the tougher questions. And they asked us, did you have a doubt at any day that you would lose? And I told them, look, this is like Olympics. Every day you wake up and every day you want to get a gold medal. It's a split of a seconds between you and adversaries in this game. Who's going to end the game with a victory? And every day you have to wake up and be at your best and put that best in a fight to save that threat from your client. And I have no doubt that our team is one of the best. But just being the best and having the best team is not always a gold medal. at Olympics at that day.
That's an intense story. So thank you so much for sharing it with us. I think that that's a perfect example, very memorable for an incident response scenario. That leads me to my next question, which is, you know, how does an incident response retainer fit into this? Like, you know, how would an organization fit that in, and how does it help? I'm sure you have everyone's attention now with that story. So
think of the incident response retainer as your annual conversation with the cyber doctors, and you pay your premium for insurance, and now you want to drive the value in that insurance. So it also means that somehow that organization really cares at a certain level and wants to engage a certain level of activities with that provider. And that's why there are tiers in the incident response retainer. It's not only budget, it's also being very honest how much organization can absorb in a month, in a quarter, in a year. Imagine then some of us are forced to go every week for 4 or 5 hours to the doctor for all kinds of tests. And you know, while that sounds really great, like you're gonna know a lot about yourself and a health, is that really necessary? How much really knowledge you need to know? And that's what the organizations try to measure when they have incident response retainer. Like not having a retainer means that, well, you're not gonna have these conversations, you're not gonna have these tests. Having a retainer means that, yes, I do wanna have these conversations with the cyber doctors, and I do wanna have some tests and checkups every quarter or every year, and then define them in a form of a tabletop, pen test, deeper technical assessment, or just review on my incident response plan from holistic communication point of view, how my executives would be engaged, what the C-level branch would do, how the incident response handler or management would really work as a propagation from manifest leadership, directors, managers, and technical resources. Having that incident response retainer drives that overall transparency in a process. What can be done to avoid or prevent an incident? Like what are the signs that lead to an incident? And where you are or organization is an incident, what really to do and how to deal with it? And from the first story that I mentioned, one of the very powerful slides that CEO of that organization felt very powerful was, I had a message there from Adam Levin, who used to run a company called CyberScout. And his message was, cyber breach is one of the life certainties between the paying taxes and debt. And while that might sound like a gloomy, the reality is during our lives, also as an individuals, we're gonna be exposed to certain sicknesses and maybe just simple cold. But sometimes in humankind, it's like really deadly type of diseases like a cancer and like a cyber cancer. And there is a probability game, and none of us know in our lifetime what we are facing. And this is very comparable to the business. Internet was not invented for safety. Imagine a coronavirus pandemic. Basically, on internet looks like you are in a room with 5 billion people you can't isolate because their traffic is 100 milliseconds from you. And now, what is a cure and prevention? What is that mask, ultimate mask, when you are in a room really packed up of 5 billion people less than 6 feet from you? That's the internet today. 5 million people less than 100 milliseconds from you. So that retainer really explains some of the concepts, maybe as heavy as we had to explain concepts of quantum physics, like the Schrodinger cat, right? Why the kid is alive and dead at the same time. And some of these concepts are exactly like that Schrodinger cat. It's just hard to believe that that's what the quantum physics is. We try to explain to these executives that, look, you have to look holistically at that risk. Let us tell you probability of that risk. Let us tell you in that probability, what is the impact to you? Example, 4% probability of a cyber cancer nation state equals around 30% of lost revenue, potentially lost 30% of your workforce, and on and around anywhere between 10 million to 200 million worth of penalties for all kinds of non-compliance and actions that probably should do, but you haven't done it, which is normal because none of us done everything that you need to do. It's just the way the life is. Like none of us goes to the doctor every month for all the checkups they should. We just don't do that. So having that incident response retainer really helps work the executive branch to understand the risk, then create streamline to operations for C-level executive and CISO, and then enables the technical team really practice the art of incident response How would you respond and what would you do? Military is good at what they do because they practice. And this is basically incident response mimic. Practice, 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 and training.
Fantastic analogies as always. And actually, I have spoken with Adam Levin on the show before. We talked about QR code risks. But anyway, so I mean, with all of that, I can hear board members, I guess we could say, like, you know, saying like, well, don't some organizations just never get hacked? So, you know, we don't need to pay for all these things or what have you. Is that something that is real? Like, I feel silly asking that, but I think it's a question that some people really think, and people in positions of power and leadership, like, don't some organizations just never get hacked?
They do. Very good example is Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Many intelligence agencies try to penetrate the systems for Al-Qaeda, especially for Osama bin Laden. And he did a very simple thing. He actually fully disconnected from the internet, and he ran the connectivity through a Pakistani intelligence agency just for his email and some high-level conversations that he was only receiver, but not truly a correspondent. And he created three layers of messengers to get to him. And that's how the Special Activity Center, that's ran by one of the intelligence agencies, we all know who they are, was able to get to him. But the casualties were very high to get into him. Many operators were killed, bombs were detonated at the Air Force bases, 13 officers died in just one bombing. So you're talking hundreds of people on the American side die. To answer the question, look at the terrorists. As bad as it sounds, they master how not to get hacked. But is that how we want to live as an organization? And the answer is probably no, right? That's a very difficult extreme between the life and death of these individuals and organizations who choose that. So the normal organization connected to the internet with normal level of interaction in society has to expect some of the touch points from the threat actors. That doesn't mean they're going to get hacked. But it also means that the level of interaction is very simple. And I think that we mentioned this before. It's like a cyber cold, cyber flu, and cyber cancer. Meaning if I'm walking on the streets of New York and I get a cold, you know, no problem. Do something over the counter, I cure it. If I get some more virus, you know, look, viruses are bad. Look what happens. Some people really die, right? But they're not that bad. It's not like everyone's going to die right away. And it's not like you can't get out of it. It's like most people actually do get out of it, but still there's population that it's bad. So that's something that's curable. So are you not going to be touched when you have to walk on the streets of New York? And the answer is you will be. So the only organizations that are not going to be compromised, truly 100%, are organizations not engaging in active communications and open channels to the internet. And very limited conversations back and forth to internet. I remember like the agencies were piloting the systems where operators would use cloud computers who basically would translate the messages like from one side to another. Almost like imagine tomorrow, you know, you, Hillary, and Lauren are hired to receive a PDF document. Then you take this document, you print it on one printer. Then you go to next room, not the same printer, next room. You scan that document and you send that document internally, like almost like air gap type of a system. And some of those has been very successful, right? And there are computer systems that are now, for example, do this browsing type of activities in this air gap type of a control systems. But let's keep in mind that it's very limited. It's primarily in the military and intelligence, not very usable for a business, not practical for a business. Any CEO you're going to talk to is going to say that technology has to enable the business. Now we're talking technology that prevents business, prevents revenue, prevents happy customers. If that organization is in that business, that customer is only, let's say, intelligence community, military, and gathering, I can imagine that. And those systems do exist, but they're not very practical for a commercial enterprise.
What about any unused hours? Like, what happens with those?
Usually when an organization... Like if you look at the DFS 500 in New York, that actually requires financial institutions to have a retainer that has two components. Under that regulation, DFS 500, financial services regulation, the retainer needs to have something called SLA, meaning that a provider has to have a time to respond over the phone, remotely and on site. So you're talking almost like calling a polling station. In addition, there has to be a commitment from that provider on certain number of hours. And the reason why the DFS 500 and some of these regulation has those hours is that the provider has to lock the resources and commit at least the minimum care standard for that victim. So generally, like under DFS 500, it's like a 50 hours. And what happens, what you pointed out, Hillary, if those hours are never used in any active incident? Well, then organization should consume those hours for something meaningful, what we mentioned before, some proactive activities around incident response, management, and also around the cyber risk and resiliency. There is always something each of us can do for ourselves. There's always something organization can do to increase its cyber posture and resiliency. And if it's not necessarily incident response because they feel very strong, there's something else from compliance, third-party risk, threat intelligence, maybe conduct very specific pen tests related to web applications, API integrations. There's always something that organization can do to better. And as we know, human beings, the only way to advance is to have every generation better than previous ones. Doesn't mean, and I'm not implying better people, but I truly what I'm talking about, being living longer and make more impact by the knowledge and energy that we put in what we do. And we should do that because that's a legacy from our fathers, to do this better, to do this smarter, to do this quicker, and preserve what we have. And that's the maybe mantra of every organization as well. What is that we can do better tomorrow? So take these 50 hours, look at your cyber posture, and then pick something that should be rendered as a service, and that's your unused hours.
My final question for you, Andre, it's kind of a big one, but purchasing a retainer versus building an in-house response plan, I'd love for you to weigh in for us on what you think is better.
Well, at many organizations, I heard this before, we've got everything what we need, and it's true. It can be true. When you look at some of the Fortune 10 players, they've got a plethora of professionals from a variety of the backgrounds. In that scenario, I would say the incident response retainer is a staff augmentation contract, meaning when an organization is attacked, you need to have a partners and friends who's going to support you. Look at the war in Ukraine. You need to have ecosystem of the partners that are going to supply you weapons, people, technology, whatever that is. Why? Because you are under attack. And that attack might be much more heavy. And also, you combat that attack sooner, like more you probably deploy, right? Like in human life, you have better pills, better technology, more people, right? It's the combat with the threat actor is shortened. So the answer to those organizations, and if you look at them, they also start believe that, well, we build everything internally. Staff augmentation actually makes sense because then we can augment our people, reinforce what we have. And now even more, because we have so many individuals around the world, we need to integrate with our third-party provider for incident response. Another view is, look at the way we address any physical threat. So let me walk you. In New York, we have NYPD. Then we have state institutions. Then we have a federal, which is basically Bureau and Secret Service, so the FBI and United States Secret Service. Then we have National Guards on the military side. We have, of course, two intelligence agencies overseeing from some of the intel that's coming to the critical infrastructure in New York, which New York is a critical infrastructure because of the financial institutions. And of course, we have large hospitals here and airports, energy grid, right? So we've got quite a bit in a heavy populated area. And then you have a very specialized forces from the development groups at a NAWAL, Navy, various SEAL team, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and cyber A6 teams, and you find that. Then you have an Air Force, there's a lot of air reconnaissance, surveillance, intelligence, to looking at the signals, breaking the signals, looking at the signals that would, let's say, tailor the United States, including New York. And then you have a very formidable group that are working under Article Title 10 or 50 by U.S. Congress and the presidents directly on order at what we call the Special Activity Center. Right, the Special Activity Centers run something called 30 Optio, which are the elite groups for the United States to dealing with the most significant adversaries in a very offensive type of a fashion. Let's go back to the normal organization. How organization can build all those skill sets from NYPD to highly specialized activity centers and special operational groups? Sure, the Fortune 10 can. The answer to the normal organizations, you cannot. And if you think you do, you are lying to yourself. Basically, what you're saying is you've got an individuals on your team that can win an Olympic medal in four disciplines. and they train for those four disciplines? And the answer is they don't. Because when you attack by the threat actors, it's a very specific threat actor. Look at the Riot Group. These are former cyber intelligence operators out of Russia. They're cyber snipers. They're deadly. They have their craftsmen, and their trademark comes from those intelligence operations. Tradecraft, they learned, is very significant. That's how these people, three people in a combat, three snipers, killed 200 people. Because they understand something that those individuals don't. The same for the cyber warriors, the very formidable adversary to take down 100 professionals, 5-6 of them, down and with the whole network, and they bury them, just the way the game is. Someone says, well, it's kind of unfair that you have cyber-trained ex-individual, like a cyber 007 Bond, attacking a normal corporation. It's almost like dealing with these ninjas, and like how normal person can even deal with that when never had such a training. And the answer is, life was never fair. Who told you life is fair, right? So building an insight, managers and certain levels is crucial and instrumental for a business. At the same time, organization needs to understand what skill set from the cyber 007 would be outsourced. What is that that they cannot build? And be very honest that if this happened, we have to go here and ask for help. And that honesty really means that organization will truly assess what they are capable of and what they are not, and what would they outsource, let's say through technology, and what they really need to outsource, almost like a cyber SEAL Team 6 type of institution.
Andre, another great conversation with you and another great episode for Life's a Breach. So I know you're really busy and just really appreciate you taking the time to share with us all of your great knowledge, war stories, and analogies. Thank you so much, Andre.
Thank you, Hilary, and looking forward to next episode.
I am too. Thank you. Life's a Breach is a Cybercrime Magazine podcast series sponsored by Security Scorecard, the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with millions of organizations continuously rated. Through a customer-centric, solution-based commitment to their partners, Security Scorecard is transforming the digital landscape by building a path toward resilience. To learn more about our sponsor, visit securityscorecard.com.